You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Super Bad True Love Story by Evgenia Peretz. But her political will began to tilt toward the unethical. In February of 2012, something unexpected was happening at UF. 2 days before the election, a popular football coach had endorsed a student football player, a member of the Independent Party, on the front page of the college newspaper, The Alligator. This was a five-alarm fire to the Unite students. The day before the election, Waldman and Senate President Jason Timier stole 268 copies of the newspaper from a stand on campus and threw them into the garbage. When another student spotted them and reported it to the paper, the campus police got involved. Waldman denied it. She dug in her heels, recalls Dwyer. She thought the newspaper had wronged her for even reporting it. But a few weeks later, Timier came clean in a column in The Alligator and apologized. He outed Waldman as his partner. Cornered, Waldman lashed out, claiming that at the time she had told Timier not to steal the papers. In the wake of the incident, an Alligator column called for Waldman's resignation to no avail. Her close friend, Christina Bonarigo, the Unite Party's spokesperson, stated that it was not Waldman's duty to stop the criminal action and that Waldman did all that she was required to do. Waldman was promoted to the position of budget and allocations chairwoman. According to a classmate, Waldman laughed about the whole episode. She wore it as a badge of honor. Cassia Laham, her high school classmate, who was now at UF, could only shake her head. The thing with Katie, bad behavior always got rewarded. The Unite Party was so tarnished by the episode that it disbanded and reformed under another name. But Waldman went on her merry way. After graduating in 2014, she landed a job in Washington as a press assistant for the National Republican Senatorial Committee. By this time, Miller had moved along from his role as press secretary for Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, a job Horowitz had helped secure, and was now communications director for Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, a staunch immigration opponent, the perfect ideological match. Miller worked the phones with reporters in constant attack dog mode. In the spring of 2013, a bipartisan group of senators, known as the Gang of Eight, had come up with a bill that offered increased border security in exchange for a path toward citizenship, a repellent idea to Miller and his boss. Miller called Hill reporters and others around the clock to bludgeon it. Thanks in part to his lobbying, the bill died. He was living comfortably in a $1 million apartment that his parents bought him in the city center, D.C., a condo and shopping complex featuring stores like Gucci and Hermes. But he was still single and apparently not loving it. As his uncle David Glosser recalls, during a Thanksgiving over that period, Miller's parents asked him whether he had met any nice girls. He exploded at the table, saying the subject was completely off-limits. They backed off. He did catch the eye of someone, though, a disheveled older gentleman named Steve Bannon. The CEO of Breitbart knew of Miller's work with Bachmann and Sessions and remembered the kid from the Larry Elder show. He eagerly brought him into the fold, where Miller practically became part of the staff, crafting the website's alt-right platform. He filled young reporters' inboxes with white nationalist fare from V-Dare and American Renaissance and encouraged them to read the 1973 novel The Camp of the Saints a neo-Nazi favorite, about a group of feces-eating Indian refugees who overrun Europe. Presumably aware that this wasn't a good look, he kept his passion for such literature hidden from public view. At the same time, Bannon was building candidate Donald Trump. When Trump announced his run at Trump Tower, famously claiming that Mexico was sending rapists to America as its dumping ground, Miller felt a thrill. He later told the Washington Post, "Everything that I felt at the deepest levels of my heart were now being expressed by a candidate for our nation's highest office before a watching world." At Bannon's suggestion, the Trump campaign offered the young man the opportunity of a lifetime to come on to Trump's campaign as a speechwriter and advisor. As an added bonus for Miller's parents, this meant a new pool of women who might like him. Miriam had joked to her cousin Patty Glosser, with whom she was especially close, "I'm putting you in charge of finding him a nice Jewish girl." Now, according to Patty, Miriam said, "Well, maybe Ivanka can do it." She was excited by the whole hoopla. On a team filled with unpleasant people, Miller fit right in. "He was just a dick," says a former campaign official. "Very territorial, not warm, just bleh." The national spotlight emboldened his rhetoric. In television appearances, he delivered fact-filled diatribes in an air-hogging monotone. He made outrageous claims, like that immigration would lead to mass female genital mutilation. He worked similarly vivid bombast into Trump's speeches about immigrants who stomp on their victims, slash them with machetes, and into his own warm-up act, which he performed before the crowds at rallies. At one such event in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, where the Glosser branch of his family is from, Miller talked about the town's former glory and invoked the names of his relatives Izzy and Sam. David Glosser, hearing the names of his beloved father and grandfather used in connection to Miller's vitriol, could stay silent no longer. He posted on the Johnstown newspaper's Facebook page, "If in the early 20th century the USA had built a wall against poor, desperate immigrants of a different religion, like the Glossers, all of us would have gone up the crematoria chimneys with the 6 million other kinsmen." Glosser says he received an avalanche of support from Glossers everywhere, even ones he'd never heard of. Alas, Miller's mother, Miriam, wasn't enthusiastic about the post, to say the least, says Glosser. And then Trump got elected. Miller was no longer an acolyte. He had ascended. Days after the inauguration, Miller and Bannon crafted the executive order banning travel from 7 majority Muslim countries, with no guidance for how to implement it. Chaos and confusion erupted at the airports and around the country, and that was the point. Miller wanted the public to know that America was not what people thought it was. The words on the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free," weren't meant to be there, he told America. Furthermore, none of this was up for debate. As he announced, "The whole world will soon see, as we begin to take further actions, that the powers of the president to protect our country are very substantial and will not be questioned." Waldman, meanwhile, had become press secretary for Montana Senator Steve Daines. Though Daines praised her very strong personality and incredible work ethic, Montana Post editor Don Pogreba recalls an approach that was immature and pedantic. When he tweeted that a congressional bill to get rid of Obamacare could kill 25,000 people, she scolded him for his dangerous rhetoric and tweeted back, "Where in the bill does it say that? Point me to that bill text." She moved on to bigger things. In late 2017, she landed a job in communications at the Department of Homeland Security, just before Kirstjen Nielsen took over as secretary. Among its roles, the department oversaw the security of the southern border, Stephen Miller's life obsession. By 2018, migrants from Central America were approaching the border by the tens of thousands. From his perspective, the only way to deter people from coming to the border would be for them to see families suffer as vividly as possible. Miller just needed to wrest control away from DHS. For several months, working with the heads of ICE and Border Security, he tried to get Nielsen to sign off on a zero-tolerance memo, which would effectively lead to family separation. Stephen was particularly trying to insert himself into the communications shop, says a former DHS official. He had this thing about calling everyone and trying to get the answer he wanted. He found that person in Katie Waldman. Did Waldman see Miller as the Sebastian Valmont of the Trump set? It's unclear. What was clear was that Waldman became a virtual extension of Miller's team. The storylines she shared with the press might have come directly from his mouth. Migrants, she said, were violent mobs. The caravans, she told Fox's Brian Kilmeade, were publicity stunts. After a few months of holding off, Nielsen effectively signed family separation into policy. According to the new book Separated by MSNBC's Jacob Soboroff, Waldman told him that the intention of putting children in cages was to shock, just as Miller had said. She took a number of trips to the border, which she chronicled on Instagram. Waldman, wearing a black T-shirt and sunglasses, grinning, with the caption, "Living my best life at the border wall." As she later told Soboroff, "DHS sent me to the border to see the separations for myself, to try to make me more compassionate, but it didn't work." The admission didn't surprise college classmates I spoke with. One says that "I genuinely believe there's something wrong with her. She lacks a moral compass and demonstrates elements of a sociopath." When pressed by Soboroff as to whether she was a white nationalist, she said no, but that immigrants should assimilate. "Why do we need to have Little Havana?" she mused. The images of children in cages, the audio of toddlers wailing for their mothers and fathers, made their way around the world. Members of Miller's extended family wrung their hands in collective despair at how such a man could have emerged from the family line. Patty had written several letters to Miriam over the years, but never sent them. Now she did. I said, "Your father would be ashamed. Please tell me that you don't agree with this. Please tell me that you don't, Miriam." And she never responded to me. Miller's childhood rabbi, Neil Comus Daniels, powerfully rebuked him in a sermon. Family separation was a PR disaster. In June 2018, at the urging of the First Lady and Ivanka, Trump signed an executive order officially canceling the policy, though he still wanted to enforce it, according to reports. Miller and Waldman looked for ways to reinstate it under a different name, which alarmed her colleagues. The next month, the Senate would hold a hearing about family separation. Among the officials to be questioned was Commander Jonathan White, who was in charge of those efforts at Health and Human Services. As Soboroff recounts, in a practice session for the hearing, White was asked if separation would be harmful to children's mental health. Waldman wanted him to respond that there was no way to know. White said he would stick to the facts, thank you. Waldman went at him, calling him a bleeding-heart liberal. He exploded at her. "You literally traumatized these kids. Why don't you peddle your story to people who don't work in immigration?" The truth soon came out. Miller and Waldman weren't just ideological partners over the course of this period. They had been falling in love, a fact she was keeping from colleagues, especially Nielsen. According to a friend, she had wanted to find a Jewish partner, But the pool of Republican Jews in Washington was small. The courtship would have been uncomfortable to most people, says this friend. Everywhere they went, people hated on them, on him. They would go out for dinner, and strangers from the next table would ask how she stomached him. But Waldman, who by February 2019 was working as Senator Martha McSally's spokeswoman, seemed giddy about her new life alongside Miller. Together, they were the Mr. and Mrs. Smith of MAGA, working to purge her former department of those who'd stood in the way of Miller's policies. In March 2019, Waldman showed up at Nielsen's practice session before she was to testify before Congress. The interpretation was that she was there to be Miller's eyes and ears. Nielsen was forced out a month later. Waldman's former DHS colleagues believed that she was the source behind a Washington Examiner article about the imminent firing of two more DHS officials whom Miller was targeting, which was news to those officials. Those officials found the source's statements to be rife with gross distortions and falsehoods. It seems his power was exhilarating to her. At the wedding of a college friend, a guest recalls how she breezed in and out with perfunctory niceties, excused Miller's absence, and bragged about how he hadn't flown commercial in years. A college classmate jokes, "I would guess she reads news coverage of him as foreplay." She moved up the career ladder beside him. In October 2019, she landed the plum job of Pence's press secretary. A month later, Katie and Stephen announced their engagement. According to a relative, members of Katie's own clan were distressed by the union. Extended Waldman family members shared their concerns with Katie's parents. As much as her parents might have preferred a different son-in-law, they felt it was not their decision to make. Katie assured people that there was a different side to him, that he was kind and caring. When this relative met Stephen, that other side was not apparent. As Katie and Stephen exchanged vows that perfect February day, COVID-19 was spreading unchecked throughout the country. Pence was about to be tapped to lead the coronavirus task force. To be sure, Trump set the ignorant anti-science tone. Katie, by virtue of being the task force's press secretary, might have tried to steer the messaging in a more responsible, informed direction. Instead, she seemed to be a blithe minion. At an early press conference, Deborah Birx, FDA head Stephen Hahn, and Surgeon General Jerome Adams had arranged themselves on the stage about 10 feet apart from one another. Katie emerged from backstage, and with an insistent smile, motioned for them to get closer, closer, closer. The officials did as they were told. The public is desperate for real information, but Katie has seemed content to treat members of the press, like Trump did, as annoying, rude nuisances. At a press conference in early March, reporter Brian Karam asked Pence if the White House had any guidance for the uninsured getting tested for COVID-19. Pence ignored the question and rambled on about how the risk to Americans was low. As the task force moved to exit the room, Karam tried to ask his question again, and then a third time, his voice rising to a yell in exasperation. Katie snapped, screaming for the camera, "Isn't going to get you anywhere." Karam wasn't especially surprised. A veteran of many administrations, he'd long felt that the Trump press people were the worst. Juvenile, arrogant, so incomplete in their knowledge they have no idea they even lack knowledge, and that she embodies all of that. What offended him was the obvious callousness toward American people suffering. "This administration doesn't care. And it's obvious from her response to me that there's little consideration for anyone outside their own bubble." Weeks later, when Pence was delivering PPE to a rehab facility in Alexandria, Virginia, She stood talking to a group of reporters. They wore masks, but Katie did not. She was well aware of the controversy. The previous week, Pence hadn't worn a mask to the Mayo Clinic and was promptly shamed into admitting that he should have. As Deborah J. Saunders of Las Vegas Review-Journal later reported, Katie had coughed, then joked to them that she didn't have the coronavirus. The next day, Katie tested positive for the virus. Trump let it slip that a wonderful woman in his administration, Katie, had tested positive, leaving it to reporters to figure out who exactly it was. Mrs. Miller emerged a few weeks later to thank well-wishers and to announce that she was pregnant. 8 months into the virus, the messaging from the task force has been catastrophic. At press time, more than 178,000 Americans had died, a toll exacerbated by the administration's misinformation and lack of concern. The plague has disproportionately hit people of color and, of course, the elderly. Among the recent victims is Stephen's own grandmother, Ruth Glosser, who died in early July. Her son, David Glosser, castigates the administration for its disastrous response to the coronavirus. The White House has denied that COVID-19 was the cause of her death, even though it is on the death certificate. Even while downplaying COVID-19, Stephen has used the disease as a tool for his xenophobia. After calling it the foreign virus in Trump's March Oval Office address, he has used it to curb immigration in every new way he can. On August 10th, the New York Times reported that Trump was considering blocking U.S. citizens from re-entering the country if border officials suspect COVID-19 exposure. The report attributed the push to Miller's assault on immigration. Miller has seized the messaging of the other national crisis, the civil unrest stemming from the murder of George Floyd. The target has shifted from immigrants to the supporters of Black Lives Matter, but the rhetorical flourishes are the same. Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children, Stephen wrote in Trump's Mount Rushmore speech. Words that by now sound like white noise. Once intent on taking control of DHS, Stephen is watching his fantasies of punishment unfold on television with militiamen in camouflage, whom he calls heroes, pulling protesters off the street and throwing them into unmarked vans. These may be the Millers' final days this close to the sun, but for some of his family members, even a Trump defeat won't end the nightmare. I personally believe that he should be tried for crimes against humanity, says Patty Glosser of her young relative. Katie could easily find herself at a place like Fox, a new Irina Briganti. Stephen will likely find a role at a far-right think tank or a Breitbart-like corner of the web. The worry among his relatives is that Stephen has laid the groundwork for longevity. When he's in his 60s or 70s, or even sooner, we could go through this all over again, fears Patty. Will we become a kinder, gentler nation? Or will we continue on the path that we are on? Avedon Ascendant, making his name in the fashion world, the legendary portraitist Richard Avedon came of age artistically and sexually in the high bohemia of the 1940s and 50s. Biographer Philip Gefter asserts that the photographer and his creative contemporaries were forecasting the future of the culture and the modern American woman. Photographs by Lillian Bassman and Paul Himmel. Opening photo, Bright Young Things, Doe and Dick Avedon on the Fire Island Dunes. Richard Avedon and his young wife, Doe, had no idea what they were getting into when they agreed to take a beach house share in the summer of 1946 with his boss at Harper's Bazaar, Lillian Bassman, and her husband, photographer Paul Himmel, in Cherry Grove, a community of bohemian intellectuals on Fire Island, 90 minutes outside of New York City. The slender barrier island, dotted with scrub and brush and dunes, was reachable only by public ferry or private boat. Cars were not allowed. During the day, when the sun was out, the shimmering reflections on the ocean to the south and the glassy waters of the Great South Bay to the north created a unique and astonishing kind of light. That summer was a fertile one for Dick, as everyone called Avedon, barely 23, fresh out of the Merchant Marine, and already absorbing the enormous benefits of his new friendship with his housemates. Bassman, under the tutelage of the legendary design eminence Alexei Brodovich, was the art director of Junior Bazaar, with whom Avedon was now working regularly. Himmel was a talented photographer who also had studied with Brodovich. The two couples occupied a bare-bones cottage with no electricity or running water. They used kerosene lamps for light and pumped water from a well to wash their dishes and flush the outhouse toilet, and yet the absence of modern creature comforts hardly mattered. In a way, the circumstances of Dick's new professional life at Harper's Bazaar had echoed his home life. Brodovich was a dictatorial father figure. Carmel Snow, the magazine's editor-in-chief, was as spirited and attentive as Avedon's mother. Lillian and Paul, meanwhile, unconventional, provocative, and culturally alert, provided more than an ample surrogate for Avedon's close cousin Margie, who, throughout his childhood, had been a precocious and cheeky co-conspirator. Both Bassman and Himmel would turn out to be of enormous influence on Avedon, professionally and emotionally. Dick was now ensconced in an entirely new kind of symbiosis of work and play that challenged him with a set of growing pains tantamount to a cultural repubescence. Dick and Doe would take the train out on weekends and have dinner with Lily and Paul at the hotel, the only place in Cherry Grove with electricity and running water. The Stinger was a favorite drink. Brandy and creme de menthe, a good stiff knockout drink, Bassman said. They would eat and drink and laugh and dance barefoot until 3 or 4 in the morning. The Lindy, the Tango, One Steps, and then go swimming in the ocean. Dick was amazing, Lillian said about Avedon's Friday night arrivals. He would be so hyper that he would order 2 dinners and go right through them. It was an extraordinary kind of hypertension, I guess, really joyful and fun, but at the same time, something else was going on inside him. Her implication was that Dick was confronting not only the rigors of his new working life, but also a host of personal issues of a darker, more complicated psychological and sexual tenor. It became clear to the Bassman Himmels soon enough that Dick's relationship with Doe was one of romantic affection, but not of physical passion, and Cherry Grove offered temptations that were exotic and deeply thrilling. Yet for Dick, ultimately, terrifying. Paul and I were free spirits, and there were dunes, Bassman said, explaining that she and Paul would lie around naked, sometimes alone, sometimes with other friends, and everybody would run down to the water with abandon and swim. She remembers Dick and Doe being shy and abashed, taking almost half the summer before they felt comfortable enough to shed their inhibitions and finally most of their clothes. I still have pictures of them, at least in my head, Dick and Doe running down the beach in their jeans, looking like two boys, arms around each other. She was a beautiful girl and not masculine in any way, but they were both slim and young, looking like brother and sister. Next photos, suddenly that summer. The Avedons clamming and lounging with housemate Paul Himmel. Lillian Bassman, beachside with the Avedons. Dick and Doe on the Fire Island ferry. Cherry Grove attracted artists, writers, actors, and young theater producers, a place where conventional rules and mainstream thinking was actively, if theatrically, derided. It was a place where every stanza of the Cole Porter song Anything Goes, written in the previous decade, would make a suitable anthem. The artist collective, Pajama, for example, which consisted of the painter Paul Cadmus, who was the lover of Jared French, and French's wife, Margaret Hanning, Pajama, deriving from the first two letters of their first names, along with another menage a trois, George Platt Lines, Monroe Wheeler, and Glenway Westcott, spent many summers in the nearby Fire Island community of Saltaire. Lines was for years a photographer at Vogue, and thought to be, in contemporary parlance, the quintessential urbane gay man of his era. He lived in a closeted bubble of privilege, protected by a traditionally stylish public veneer, surrounding himself with a group of artists, writers, and attractive dancers from the New York City Ballet, co-founded by his friend Lincoln Kirsten. He regularly hosted parties in his Park Avenue apartment, reputed to be as elegant as they were orgiastic. Lines would make many photographs of Pajama at Cherry Grove, some of them posing in the nude, positioned against the architectural framework of the lifeguard stands along the beach. "We walked to Cherry Grove when the sand was hard," Cadmus remembers. "We'd go to check out the gay life there." Westcott, the poet and novelist, offered this glimpse of the scene in his journal. "Just beyond these bungalows, just over the dunes, there lies heavenly landscape, sandscape, with delights of the flesh and the weather, more selfish than anything in the world. Friday night when we arrived, they took me down to the beach. The harvest moon had just risen. It seemed to have come up terribly excited, like a bull into an arena." Bassman described Cherry Grove as a very gay community, but at that time also very literary, you know. A lot of producers and directors and poets, Auden, people like that. Dick would soon photograph W. H. Auden at his house in Cherry Grove, where Auden's good friend, Christopher Isherwood, author of the Berlin stories, would sometimes visit. The artist Pavel Schlittenschuh had a house there with his lover, Charles-Henri Ford. Janet Flanner summered there, as did Benjamin Britten and his lover, Peter Peers. Writer Truman Capote was a regular visitor, as was playwright Tennessee Williams. Among the weekend guests who stayed with Dick and Doe and Lily and Paul were the photographer Carl Bissinger, whose romantic partner, Johnny Nicholson, would open Cafe Nicholson on East 58th Street in the city, which became a popular gathering spot for the so-called New Bohemians, including Williams, Tanaka Leclerc, Donald Wyndham, Buffy Johnson, and Gore Vidal, the group famously documented in an alfresco photograph for Flair magazine. Leonard Gersh, a young playwright whom Dick got to know while in the Merchant Marine, shared the house with them one summer. He would go on to write a play called Wedding Day, modeled on the Avedons, that would become the 1957 hit movie Funny Face, starring Fred Astaire as Dick, Avery, and Audrey Hepburn, a sometime Avedon model, as Joe, based on Doe. William Alexander MacDonald III, a decorator, would come out and stay too. As Bassman recalled, he always made champagne eggs on the kerosene stove. Next photos, Fire Island in focus. At Duffy's Hotel Bar, Cherry Grove. Ford model Natalie Nickerson on Avedon's first Harper's Bazaar cover, January 1947, epitomized the photographer's vision of the modern woman. A late 1940s Himmel portrait of a 20-something Avedon exuding confidence and sensual allure. While Lily was technically Dick's boss, it was through their natural rapport and playful collaboration that she was able to coax out of him fresh and original visual solutions to their editorial problems. Her husband, Paul, also photographed over the years for Bazaar and Vogue and brought a different set of winning, if at times brooding, qualities to the evolution of the friendship between the two couples. Paul was literary, political, and witty. "My dad was killer sarcasm," Lizzie Himmel said. "He was an amazing speaker and teller of stories. He was handsome, too, almost dandyish, working out on a daily basis to keep his body in excellent shape. His sexuality was, say, fluid, and he seemed perfectly comfortable about it, which might have added to Dick's conflicted feelings about the lure of same-sex attraction in that environment. My father was way less gay-shy than Dick was," Lizzie said. "I think that Dick was wildly in love with my mother, but I think he was very attracted to my father." Bassman, who was then 29, and Himmel, 3 years older, had both grown up in politically progressive families in which atheism and communism, respectively, gave them an existential resolve about living life in the present, as well as an egalitarian sense of justice. Lillian studied art at Pratt Institute and would eventually become a consequential fashion photographer. Paul's sultry photographs of city life exploited the romance of dark shadows, watery reflections, and patterns of light in a way that was consistent with his contemporaries Saul Leiter and Louis Farrar. Lillian and Paul struck an unselfconscious posture of enlightened irreverence that Dick simultaneously reveled in and shied away from. For Doe, by contrast, an aspiring actor who had several modest roles on Broadway, their uninhibited nature seemed more compatible with her own. According to Lizzie, her parents were, by turns, intellectual, discriminating, political, artistic, original, and ultimately restless. Her brother Eric corroborates, "Finally, inevitably, it was a worldview, a way of looking out at others that could seem infuriatingly smug to outsiders, but had undeniable strength, valuing above all else creativity, productivity, and unconventionality." "It was the beginning of a great relationship," Bassman said about the Avedons, describing how close the four of them were during those years and how much fun the two couples had together, sitting on the beach all day, swimming nude, playing chess or charades at night while they drank, partying all the time. Dick and Lillian also spent some of their time in Cherry Grove as if it were an ongoing editorial meeting. They would dream up fashion features, generating much of the content for Junior Bazaar, since, in the new post-war era, there was not yet a burgeoning fashion industry to draw ideas from. They would talk about the magazine, how they would produce features, which models and designers they would use, and what the general viewpoint would be. "One time," she remembered, "sitting on the beach, Dick and I planned a whole issue around green, green vegetables, green nail polish, green clothing. So we sent the fashion editors out to find things that were green. We sent the beauty people out to get green nail polish made, and I made a layout with these wonderful drawings of vegetables." Then Dick photographed all the girls and made it look like they were climbing through these fruits. Lily and Paul made many casual pictures of Dick and Doe during their summers in Cherry Grove. In some, Dick looked scrawny, with gawky features, an awkward stance, and what were considered then to be feminized gestures. Doe had distinct and beautiful features, and such a poised manner that her entire affect is one of comfort and ease in her body. Some pictures capture the pair sweetly affectionate and happily entwined, while in others Dick looks so young and almost frail in comparison to the buoyant, demonstrative Doe that it's hard to imagine the two of them as a natural match. Yet in one casual portrait Paul made of Dick alone, he looks far more grown up and self-assured, quite handsome and virile, his features filling out the structure of his face, his eyes opened wide, his gaze deep and liquid, his lips sculptural and sensual. There is a distinct eroticism to the portrait, yet it is unclear whether it derives from amorous feelings in Himmel or from Avedon's honest gaze at the camera. Regardless, the connection between them is palpable. In this picture, Dick, formerly geeky and ill at ease, seems to be actively willing the handsome good looks he is growing into. At Harper's Bazaar, Dick still felt that he had to prove his indispensability in every single issue. He measured himself against the already impossible professional standards of excellence at the magazine and brought an acute sensitivity to everything around him. He was overly excitable in his enthusiasms, and equally he catastrophized the simplest slight. His ambition, though, fueled a growing restlessness about his career, and his elbow, as Brodovich referred to his single-minded pursuit of his work, could be sharpened by the whiff of competition. As he was spending weekends at the beach that first summer, for example, it seemed to irk him that Truman Capote was on assignment in New Orleans with the photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson for a bizarre feature called Notes on N.O. Of course, at Cherry Grove, Avedon was also absorbing an entirely new way of being, and the stimulus was overwhelming. He was meeting people unlike any he had known before, and observing behavior that came from a new set of attitudes and ideas about how to construct a life. In that community, he was forced to navigate the open physical affection of men, and consequently confront a profound shame about his own fascination, perhaps specifically with Paul. It was a kind of desire that had no place in La Façade Avedon, with which he intended to earn professional respect, gain cultural standing, and establish financial security. Dick's driving ambition propelled him to outwardly ignore these subterranean impulses, or at least to try to suppress what he feared would become professional impediments. Being openly gay would prove not to be a career obstacle for several of his close friends in the arts, such as Capote, composer Leonard Bernstein, and writer James Baldwin, and whom Avedon had co-edited their high school literary journal. Yet Dick had been conditioned to thwart his desires, not only because of the expectations of his stern father, but also as a necessary survival measure in a society hostile to gays. Newspapers reported the arrest of gay and lesbian sexual deviants, or perverts as they were often labeled, mentioning them by name, ruining their careers, destroying their lives. Since World War II, in fact, gay soldiers had been expelled from the armed forces, losing access to jobs and federal benefits due to their having been dishonorably discharged. Without question, the cultural incentive for Dick to marry had been overwhelming. There was a war going on inside him. The young Avedon had been an award-winning poet and practiced dance before turning to photography, and his finely tuned responsiveness to the sensate world all around him was in conflict with the censor's rejection of perhaps the deepest source of that sensitivity. I must tell you that we artists cannot tread the path of beauty without Eros keeping company with us and appointing himself as our guide, writes Thomas Mann in Death in Venice. Somewhere within that conflict, Dick was able to locate inspiration to create his first cover of Harper's Bazaar published in January 1947. The picture must have drawn direct inspiration from Avedon's first summer in Cherry Grove, as it conjures a beach scene without hiding the fact that it was taken in the studio. The model Natalie Nickerson faces the camera straight on, head to toe, blonde hair pulled tight behind her head, a slight impish smile on her face, a small scarf wrapped around her neck, the elbows, the sleeves of her dark sweater pulled up to her elbows, bare legs spread apart in pastel short shorts, and her bare feet planted firmly on the sand-colored floor. Behind her is a man in a bathing suit reclining, his back to the camera, his elbow propping him up, staring out at the horizon and the infinite ocean. Some people claim the male figure to be Avedon himself. The model doesn't seem to care that the man's attention is elsewhere. She has plenty going for her without his acknowledgement. Her triangular silhouette is cast in relief against the uncluttered white, seamless background, lit to suggest the glare of the sun. Dick's first cover for the magazine introduces what will long become identified as the Avedon woman, slender, androgynous, natural, spontaneous, spirited, unself-conscious, a bit kooky, and utterly self-assured. With his cover debut, Dick seemed to have been incorporating the new set of social conditions introduced to him on Fire Island into a visual representation that is dramatically contemporary. In post-war America, this fashion picture was utterly radical for its visual simplicity, its unconventionality, and ultimately its depiction of a thoroughly independent woman. There's more than a little bit of dough in the barefoot, sure-eyed model standing on the ersatz beach, game for some new excitement. Her unaffected spontaneity is a quality that came to characterize the Avedon woman throughout Dick's entire career. Avedon's real fascinations, Bassman said, were androgyny and theatricality, referring specifically to her impressions of him on Fire Island. In fact, Dick created the Harper's Bazaar cover less than 3 months after his and Doe's first glimpse of Cherry Grove, and it is not a stretch to suggest that the narrative dreamscape it depicts is also an exacting portrait of his soon-to-be-failed marriage. The couple's marriage ended in 1949, and Avedon began sessions with a psychoanalyst whose specialty included curing homosexuality long before the practice of conversion therapy was uniformly debunked. While Dick would marry Evelyn Franklin in 1951 and would have a son, John, he remained closeted for most of his life. He would have occasional affairs with men, but as a man of his generation, these relationships were clandestine and few. In February 1947, Dick was assigned to photograph Jerome Robbins, the choreographer, for a profile in Bazaar's April issue. Robbins had already been anointed a young nobleman of dance for his brilliant ballet Fancy Free, with music by Leonard Bernstein and inspired by a Paul Cadmus canvas entitled The Fleet's Inn, which culture writer Anna Kisselgoff once referred to as a typically erotic painting of sailors having a good time. Fancy Free premiered at the Metropolitan Opera House in 1944, and the New York Times dance critic John Martin singled out Robbins as a first-class artist. It was only Jerome Robbins' Fancy Free that saved the season from being predominantly dull. It is a beautifully built little ballet, gay in spirit and genuine in substance. Dick had some familiarity with Fancy Free, since the ballet's run coincided with the end of his military service, when he had been taking modern dance classes alongside John Butler and Tannekill Leclerc, who would later marry George Balanchine. Dick would have recognized himself in the three sailors, and his eye would have been attuned to their graceful physical charm, which used pure gesture to articulate pride, bravado, infatuation, sexual desire, and jealousy. The dance was underscored by Bernstein's mournful music, with its urgent rhythms and strains of melancholy in what is essentially a modern mating ritual. While Robbins and Bernstein were virtual unknowns when the show premiered that April, these new kids on the block, the Times noted, were overnight sensations, the proverbial talk of the town. Later that year, on The Town, the Broadway production that Robbins, Bernstein, Betty Comden, and Adolph Green created out of Fancy Free opened on Broadway. Both productions would go on to become milestones in American musical theater, as well as the ballet. Jerome Robbins, née Jerome Rabinowitz, from Weehawken, New Jersey, a darling of the stage and merely 5 years Avedon's senior, would serve as a kind of beacon for Dick's unbounded ambition, not least because he would find surprising similarities in their backgrounds. Like Dick, Robbins had an unforgiving father, a small businessman who did not want him to go into the arts. Robbins, likewise, had had to extricate himself from the family business in order to commence his study of dance, writes Terry Teachout. "I didn't want to be like my father, the Jew," Robbins would later write. "I wanted to be safe, protected, assimilated, hidden in among the goys, the majority." Dick would recognize Robbins' self-contempt, and not only about his Judaism. Robbins' attitude toward his queerness, as he referred to it, was equally conflicted, writes Teachout. Though he readily declared his sexual orientation to avoid serving in World War II, he also had involvements with women then and later. "Please save me from being gay and dirty," Robbins wrote in a 1942 diary entry, not long before his draft board classified him as 4F. People close to Robbins and Bernstein acknowledged that their professional relationship was like a marriage. They were very close, and their interactions could be stormy. Both were bisexual, and it's possible that they were once, briefly, lovers. Avedon would photograph Bernstein the following year, another beacon that brought the reach of his own driving ambition a little closer to the realm of his own daily reality. All three men had grown up as middle-class Jews, each one driven by an internal imperative to create something of meaning out of their own exigent talents and give it significant cultural reform. Richard Avedon later would come to realize that it generally took a decade or two for the future to happen. Prescient artists would foresee shifts in the culture and then express, and in many cases precipitate, those changes, using their artworks as auguries for what would later transpire in society at large. Such was the case in 1945, when Dick was first getting his footing at Harper's Bazaar. This article will be continued in the next installment. This article is adapted from What Becomes a Legend Most, the biography of Richard Avedon by Philip Gefter, copyright 2020 by Philip Gefter, reprinted by permission of Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Colexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.